Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Caroline Donoghue and I'm a writer and a long aside about baseball. Joining me is author and the heir to a hair pomade fortune, Sarita Domingo.
If only.
Today we're talking about Unforgivable Love by Sophronia Scott. Hi, Sarita.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for introducing me to this book and to this writer that I don't think I would have heard of otherwise. I'd love to know how you came into this book and why you chose it today.
Well, I think I'm not quite sure, actually, how I came across it. I think it might have been something I saw on Twitter a couple of years ago, because it is quite a new, well, relatively new book. It came out in 2017. But it was the premise that hooked me, because it's a retelling of Dangerous Liaisons, or Les Liaisons Dangereux.
Excellent pronunciation.
And I love the film Dangerous Liaisons, the John Malkovich, Glenn Close retelling of that story. And then this book, it's set in 1940s Harlem, African-American character, so it's like a retelling of Dangerous Liaisons, and I was like, put the two things together, I love it, I want to read it. So yeah, that was sort of what drew me to the story generally. And I wanted to read a love story that featured an entirely black cast.
Yeah, like I generally feel like quite snobby about retellings in general. It feels like every like 3 years someone comes out with like a new like Pride and Prejudice, except this time the Bennet sisters are like firefighters or something. And I'm always like, ugh, give me a fucking break. I love this retelling.
I know what you mean, in that it kind of, it feels like, well, someone else has done the labor of thinking of this whole narrative, and then you can just swoop in and sort of redo it. So I get that, but, and I'm not necessarily always drawn to read, you know, like it's not like I'm a retelling junkie or anything, but for this one, it just seemed like a really genius idea to sort of move this story into this environment. So I was into it.
Definitely. And it's like definitely a point of view, because like Les Liaisons Dangereux, Dangerous Liaisons, yes. Cruel Intentions as I best know it.
Yes.
And actually I read an interview with Sophronia Scott, and she said that like she was really into the film Dangerous Liaisons, then she read the book because she was so into the film, and then there was just apparently a summer where they kept replaying the film on cable and she just always found herself watching it. And I really relate to that sort of high low trashy sort of like, she read the original text but she also loves the trashy version with Ryan Phillippe, you know.
Yeah, which I definitely saw that, but for some reason that did not connect for me in the same way that the 1988 like sort of really, I guess, faithful retelling, because obviously if people don't know, it's based on a book from like, I guess, the 1800s or something, that a French man whose name I know I won't be able to pronounce, I think it's Pierre de Chaque something, I don't know, I'm not going to attempt it, but he wrote the original story, you know, set in like French society, and it has been retold numerous times, obviously quite famously as Cruel Intentions. But yeah, I don't know, I just, yeah, this version of it was just something that really was like right on the money for me.
And it's like, it's funny because that original version, the one that was written in France in the 18th century, you can, whenever you sort of read a retelling or see a retelling of it or whatever, it always does have this sort of like very like, I don't know what the kind of word for it is, I haven't really studied this, but you know when every, there's a lot of mustache twirling going on, yeah. The evil characters are just evil, and it's like everyone ends up sort of dead or pregnant kind of thing, or married,
yeah,
and it's like very like everything is very knitted up in the end, which can feel like when you're trying to read about it in a novelistic way with sort of slightly more contemporary characters, even though they are in the 40s, it can feel like very harsh strains to put on modern characters.
I think
she really gives them such depth in a way I found really fascinating and a real like masterclass in character building.
And it's interesting, I'm sure we'll get into it, but and I only really realized this later on, but she has kind of tweaked the ending. So she's sort of changed some of what happens to the characters in quite an interesting way, I thought. And I found it interesting whose stories she's tweaked and whose she's left sort of as they were. Yeah, particularly with the sort of central female characters and like what she's let them do or not do in this version.
Definitely. I'm going to, before we go any further, I'm going to get into the plot summary.
Yes.
Which, I mean, the thing about this is, even though I had seen Dangerous Liaisons, and even though I had seen Cruel Intentions, it's still such a complicated plot that it like really, like, it actually did keep me guessing, because there's so many characters, there's so much overlap in who's sleeping with who.
Yeah. It's a lot of scheming, a lot of meddling, a lot of interplay.
A lot of, like, rubbing of hands together.
Yes.
So, Unforgivable Love is a retelling of Dangerous Liaisons set in post-war Harlem among an elite set of the wealthy African-American upper classes. Among them, we have Mae Marveaux, a beautiful, conniving young widow whose desperate need to be loved is offset by her need to destroy other people's lives. She is obsessed with her similarly conniving friend, Val Jackson, and two of them decide to prey on Elizabeth Townsend, a devout married Christian, and Cecily, an innocent young virgin who has just been brought back from North Carolina for an arranged marriage to one of May's former lovers. Over a single summer, Cecily is deflowered, Elizabeth falls for Val, and almost everyone is either pregnant or dead.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to keep up even in the, as you say, in the summary, that you're like, oh yeah, okay, yeah.
Yeah. And then on the background of all of this is just like the most sort of gorgeous, I think, and little used setting, I think, of the Harlem Renaissance. And this thing that like I'd only really heard of because I'd sort of studied it tangentially at English at university, but this real like moment, this like eruption of like jazz culture, of poets, and there's like, they're all name checked throughout the book. There's Ella Fitzgerald, there's Langston Hughes, Cab Calloway, all these people, and this really emerging like black middle and upper class that was happening in Harlem.
Yeah, this sort of the post-war boom, like, I guess, yeah, the Harlem Renaissance, and just the opportunities that African Americans had sort of post-war to really genuinely dial into that American dream feeling, that they could be. So sort of Mae Marveaux's character, her mother, I believe, was based on Madam C.J. Walker, who was allegedly the first self-made female millionaire in the U.S., and which is fascinating that she was an African-American woman. So I think, but what I really love about the story of the setting of Unforgivable Love is that it's this insular space that African-Americans have this sort of opportunity to be so wealthy and to have that sort of privilege that we might associate with a different situation altogether, but it's all kept within their community, so their sort of interplay is all in a high society sort of setting that we don't usually get to see, as you say. But yeah, they're just sort of they're able to keep within their own community and have this sort of wealthy, I guess, aspirational setup.
Yes. Yeah, it's so good. And it's so much more... Because the thing is, when you're used to seeing... When you have these kind of period settings, you either... And if there are, like, black characters or even any non-white characters involved, it's either they are the person on the fringes who has to sort of make do and sort of... like sort of skirt around sort of white upper class.
Yeah.
Or it's like a kind of a civil rights story or something. And the this is so decadent. They're wasting so much time.
Exactly. Yeah.
There's so many characters. And like even there's like Elizabeth's husband is like a civil rights lawyer. And his story is so sidelined.
Yeah, it's just like a function to get him out of the way. He's like toiling away, sort of helping these struggling individuals down south and like,
I know. I love that. And I feel like it's almost like a wink from Scott herself, just being like, you've heard his story.
Yeah, exactly.
The story we're going to hear is the decadent, time-wasting, too much money, too much free time story.
Yeah, exactly. And it, I mean, obviously the story does kind of, obviously it doesn't completely ignore the sort of racial situation that would have been going on at the time. You know, we get the mention of Jackie Robinson, I think, Jackie Robinson, who was a baseball player who Val Jackson's character is really enamored of. And Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier in baseball. So he's the first black baseball player, I want to say, to play for the I'm going to pretend I know anything about sports. Yeah. The Yankees? I mean, I don't know.
I liked this book a lot, but the place where it lost me were the long asides about baseball.
Yeah.
I was just like, don't understand any of this like sexual discourse about innings and pitchers.
Exactly. Other than the fact that it gives the opportunity, like in films where they're like, let's play golf and like someone needs to adjust someone's swing. It was that, that's like, that was the function for me. It's like, oh yeah, help her hit a baseball or whatever. But in terms of like, I think Val's character, as far as I understand from having read a couple of interviews, Sophronia Scott used Jackie Robinson as a way for Val's character to see that there's sort of some beauty that rises above the ugliness that they're experiencing. Because I guess Jackie Robinson was very noble, I hesitate to say the word, but he kind of just tips his hat to the crowd that's like braying at him when he first steps up to the plate. And so he's a real character. And I think that that's really the only function that Scott is using race as a dynamic for. Like, she's not ignoring it, but really the only white character in it is the one that Cecily meets, which I'm sure we'll talk about. But
you know what? Let's just get to her now, because what I found so surprising about Cecily, who is the sort of the young virginal character, the one who's played by Reese Witherspoon. No, the one who's played by Selma Blair.
Is she Cruel the Intentions. Selma Blair one? Yes. In Cruel Intentions. Yeah.
Yeah, she's the one who like has that like slow kiss with Sarah Michelle Gellar that confused so many of us as young girls.
The old spittle. What?
Honestly, the spittle heard around the world. I know. It was a very awakening moment for lots of us. But the Selma Blair character, as it were, who I think in basically all adaptations of this story is the sort of silly kind of figure of fun. She's so virginal. She's so innocent. It's almost like poking fun at like, you know, the idea of this sort of like nubile young girl who's coming in wide-eyed. But weirdly, in this book, in this retelling, even though I was primed for her to be the character I ignored the most, she was the character I loved the most.
Yeah, because Cecily in this book, so Cecily comes into the fray, as it were, because we have the two sort of more seductive, deliberate characters in Mae Marvo and Val Jackson, who are sort of older, they're used to using their sexuality to sort of scheme and seduce and just have their fun in their high society sort of environment. But then Cecily, she really comes into the plot because May is displeased that Cecily, this like young, innocent, virginal character, has been selected by her former lover to be his new... like he basically wants to marry a virgin. And May is angered by this because I can't even quite remember. She's just, she doesn't like the idea of...
Literally all the toys have to be hers all the time, even when she's done playing with them.
Yeah, she's kind of insulted. Yeah, exactly. So Cecily's character is, she's supposed to be this like virginal, lovely, innocent girl. But when we meet her, she has been, she's been sent away by her mother to go and live with her aunt and uncle in North Carolina. So like away from this sort of Harlem high society. She's like on a farm learning how to, I don't know what you do on a farm, like shuck peas, I don't know, all this kind of like farm living type stuff. And she is a, I guess, she's a young woman just coming into her sexuality, kind of, but not really aware of it at the time when she's away in North Carolina. And when she goes walking in the woods, like she goes off into the woods to, I don't know, decompress. Think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she encounters, as we were saying, the only white character in the story, kind of, which is this strange man she sees, like, super communing with nature, like, literally kind of rutting around in the dirt.
Yeah.
And it's quite strange. Like, it's a really, their encounter and their dynamic really sticks with me from the book. Because then later on, she goes to get a pair of shoes and she realizes that the guy selling them shoes is the same man she's seen in the woods, that they haven't interacted at that point. But yeah, it's really, I think that sort of moment is a bit of a sexual awakening of her. She doesn't quite know what she's seeing when she sees the man in the woods.
Yeah, he's basically, for want of a better word, like jerking it into the earth.
Yeah, which is very strange. Like, I don't know where that came from. I haven't really encountered that in any other adaptation.
Yeah, yeah. It really feels like something very... It's one of the only bits of the book that, like, doesn't feel like it was drawn from anywhere other than just a part of Sophronia Scott's brain that she just needed to express. But like, I found those sections in North Carolina so beautiful.
Yeah, lovely.
And, which I was so surprised by because I don't like reading about trees normally.
not
when
interested.
I hear about like a character is like awakening in the outdoors or whatever, I'm like, come on, like get to shagging. But like, I really enjoyed like that whole section and this whole bit as well, where it's like, because Cecily has grown up in Harlem in this very sheltered way, and she sort of feels, she doesn't really know who she is, like in her, and the story of her kind of coming to know her own body is a really gorgeous one. And like, you see her in the woods and she sort of begins to notice like the rhythms of sort of nature and how things grow and change and different times for different plants, different things for different animals. And there's this brilliant, I really related to it. I really remembered this as like being a very formative teenage girl memory where like, I think when she's moved over there, she has been having her period for like a year.
Yeah.
And it's one of these things where like her mother is like, oh, keep a note of when your thing is.
Exactly.
But like, regardless, she's still always so surprised by it.
Oh, completely.
She's like forever staining
so
her
relatable.
Knickers.
Yeah, exactly.
So relatable.
Yeah.
So relatable. And then she has this thing where she's kind of in the countryside for a few months and she's really growing to love it and she loves her aunt and uncle and she starts to sort of listen to her body in this really intuitive way. And she she's like this beautiful paragraph where it's like she could feel her body getting ready for something and then it like sort of gathering and breaking and she knew it was, and it was like, I loved that sort of framing of like a woman's like menstruation as being a sort of a flag for like her getting to know herself better.
Yeah.
It was really great.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting that her character returns to that place. Don't want to do maybe spoilers. I don't know. Maybe we can do spoilers.
But, I tend to spoiler a lot.
Yeah. But she, and you really do feel the wrench when she's just getting to know herself. And then she's sort of, her mum turns up and says, you're coming back to Harlem to marry this like old man, basically. And, but she is also sort of fertile. She's ready to experience herself physically and also experience falling in love, because she then meets Sam's character, who's her music teacher, and they fall in love, and sort of she's betrothed to this other person, but she has this secret affair going on with Sam, and they're writing each other sort of cute little notes.
Yeah.
So their romance is initially still quite innocent, but then of course the manipulation comes in and she becomes the subject of Val's seduction, at the behest of May.
Yes.
Because May wants Cecily to kind of be spoiled for Frank, the guy who Cecily is meant to be marrying, who's May's former lover. Keeping up.
It's quite a lot going
on. It's a lot. So, yeah. So when May asks, she sort of makes a pact with Val to get him to seduce Cecily. And then she sort of May offers herself up as the prize if he's successful in sort of deflowering Cecily, which is like really quite, that it's quite uncomfortable, that scene where he seduces Cecily.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of assault, really.
Oh, yeah.
Not even kind of. I mean, I guess she eventually submits to it and they do begin an affair, but that's one of the most difficult aspects of the story for me.
Yeah, and there's definitely, like, with that character of Val Jackson, it took me the longest to warm up to him, I think. Mm. And I mean, warm up is probably the wrong word to use, because I think for the earliest chapters of the book, it's very like, God, he was hot and he knew it and he could have any woman he wanted and he hated them all and then he chucked them into the street and blah, blah. Although he has a very good system whereby, like, he has a there's like his valet, like, has a church dress ready.
Yes.
For all of his one night stands in the morning.
And they just, so like, they don't the have to dress. Walk of shame. Yeah.
Yeah. Which I think is very considerate. And then he sort of like fixates on Elizabeth Townsend. It's kind of this dual pact of like, he has to sort of seduce Cecily, this sort of young country virgin, and also Elizabeth Townsend, who's this very, she's like 27, she's married to the civil rights lawyer. She's a woman of God. She really knows herself and she's very quite sure of herself. And he has to sort of seduce both of them.
Yeah. So Elizabeth is his own sort of project, I guess. And then Cecily, he's seducing for May. But I guess May picks up on the fact that he's decided Elizabeth is somebody he wants to conquer as well. So she's like, well, actually, you have to succeed in all these seductions before you get to me, the grand prize. Kind of thing.
No, what a move. What a power move. Like,
exactly. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, so he goes ahead with the seduction of Cecily. And yeah, I mean, it is hard to warm to somebody who's like a charmer and a seducer, if that's the word. And especially what he does with Cecily. But then he also does kind of he sort of facilitates her awakening sexually. It's a very difficult line to tread, though, because obviously it's not voluntary on her part.
Yeah, yeah. I think about this a lot. Like, this is so unrelated and such a tangent. Mm. But you know how, like, every year there is this big thing about Baby, It's Cold Outside?
Yes.
Right? Yes. This is always just like, should we cancel Baby, It's Cold Outside? And rah, rah, rah. And it's like, it's kind of like relaying very modern sexual mores on top of a very old song. And this sort of thing with that song is that, like, you know, I really can't say all that sort of bartering that they do. You could, under a curt modern end, you can call it sort of date rape or rape culture or whatever. Mm. But there also is a very real thing where it's like, to, even if as a woman in that time period, even if you do want it, even if you do feel that longing, you're so conditioned from a, like, cradle level to reject it, that this culture of, like, I don't know what to call it, of, like, pushing past a woman's resistance when you know that resistance isn't real.
Mm. Well, and it's a difficult thing, because that is kind of a trope in a lot of traditional romance, particularly old school romance, where it's like she's saying no, but she really means yes. And it's kind of like the job of the man to elicit this response out of the woman. I mean, exactly the dynamic of Baby It's Cold Outside, the kind of no, I really mustn't, so that the woman has to perform a sense of innocence and the man has to break down that resistance somehow, which I guess, because Sophronia Scott is writing based on a story that is from the 18th century or whatever initially, that is it's difficult to adapt that sort of seduction to a more modern interpretation. And I know we're in the 40s here, but I think the general way she deals with the sexuality of the female characters is very interesting, because she kind of, she has these three different levels, like grades of woman, and where they are with their sexuality. So Cecily is completely innocent. She's not even really sure what her sexuality is. And then Elizabeth is very pious, as you know, she's a very God-fearing, dedicated to going to the church. And she sort of feels that sexuality is something she has to reject, or that it's only between her and her husband, and she mustn't give in to any feelings of sort of desire. And then you have May, who is very in control of her sexuality and has been for a very long time, and just uses it as a tool of manipulation. But even she kind of is angry at the way that Val gets to just be shagger about town and be really open about it, whereas she has to be all smart and seductive and like give the appearance of being a woman of, you know, a society or whatever, that can't be very open about her sexuality.
Yeah. And it's really interesting with May, where it's like, so she is like a sociopath. Like, she feels no regret or resentment about any of these lives she just sort of casually destroys, which is so much fun to read. Do you know what I mean? It's like, we're talking about like modern lenses and like all this, but it's like, ultimately it's like, it's fun. It's pretty, it's great.
Yeah, exactly. But I think May is the character I feel gets the sort of shortest shrift, because the other characters, you kind of get to see them grow and change. Whereas May, I think the way she's dealt with May's character is really interesting, because we have that, there's a prologue where May, as a younger woman, has her, like, a close friend, Alice, who they have, like, a semi-sexual relationship. There's kind of an implication that May is in love with this girl. So, and I'm not quite sure if Sophronia Scott is trying to imply that May is gay and that her seductions are all sort of... Because at the very end of the prologue, she... Alice gets married off to this man because she gets pregnant by, I can't remember if it's the same guy she gets pregnant by. I don't think so. But anyway, she ends up pregnant and her mum marries her off, and May is distraught. And as Alice is, like, almost as she's being dragged away, she spots some guy, which I think is actually the man she's really in love with, and tells May, "You have him for me," kind of thing. And May very calculatedly says something like, he's the first guy she's gonna get her revenge on or something. And that's really early in the book. He would be the first to pay, she says. And that's kind of setting May up as this, using her sexuality for revenge, which is really delicious to read. And it's fun to see a woman so in control of her sexuality. But she doesn't really get to fall in love, or like, she doesn't get the combination of sex and love that the other characters get. She's just kind of a manipulator, and she's cold-hearted. And then at the end, her comeuppance is that she's just shunned by society, whereas everyone else kind of gets a redemptive moment. Well, not everyone else, but kind of everyone else gets love or redemption or something. And I feel like May gets like really the short straw. It's like, is that the because she's so in control of her sexuality, is that the result that you get as a woman? I don't know.
Yeah. There definitely is this thing, and it comes back to a lot with May and with Val, that they are these two characters that just fundamentally they don't know how to be happy, because like there's this wonderful quote that I have in here somewhere. So this is something that another character, Rose, who's Val's aunt, says about May. There are people in this world who can never get other people to love them the way they want to be loved. It's like they spend their whole lives on their knees in the dirt in the woods trying to light a wet match. Can't spark nothing. The more they can't, the more they want to burn the whole forest to the ground. I can tell she's one of them. And I love how that's really well put. And I do recognize that person. And that it's that same thing with Val, where it's like, to be happy with another person, and both of them sort of, like, May wants it so badly. She wants this love that is intangible to her, because it requires a level of vulnerability that she will never be able to give. And so she says, like, for example, she, you know, Sam, who's the music teacher who falls in love with Cecily, she sort of, like, takes Sam from Cecily and takes him to Paris and, like, shows him the world in this incredible way. And then he still doesn't really love her. He has sex with her, but he doesn't really love her. And she can't fathom why he would still be so interested in Cecily.
Yeah.
It's this thing where there's this part of her that will never be accessible, and therefore she can never really be loved.
And because early on in the book, I have a quote as well, when we're, so the chapters dart between like the four characters. And in one of May's early chapters, it says, May didn't want love. She didn't care that it, May did want love, sorry. May did want love. She didn't care that it didn't last, didn't care how easily it could be broken. What she cared about was how every human being seemed to walk the earth clutching at love, but she couldn't do the same. And later on, it sort of talks about how her mum gave her all this safety and like kept her safe from want and safe from greed and safe from need. Like, she didn't want for anything. But she, there's a line that says, but it also meant she was safe, painfully, genuinely, horrifically safe from love. So it's kind of like she doesn't even know how to access love or be vulnerable, as you say, to it. Whereas Val kind of he's blindsided by it, because he thinks he's just seducing Elizabeth because she's like all pious and he's like, oh, what a challenge kind of thing. But then he genuinely falls in love with her and he's like, what is this feeling? Like, he can't quite compute what's happening, but he is genuinely in love with Elizabeth and does come to recognize it. Whereas Maid never gets that. And it's just like, oh.
Yeah, no, she never gets any form of like the plot never thanks her in the way it does with the,
exactly,
with the rest of the characters. But I feel like even just giving her that emotional depth of being this person who both wants yet can't understand how to have love does give her that level of layeredness, which you're not rooting for her, but you do sort of applaud every now and then.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
The weird thing about her character is that, like, so she's very upfront about the fact that she wants to ruin Cecily's life just for her own amusement. But then she also,
well, she really wants to ruin Frank's life, and Cecily's the way she can do it.
And so Cecily's just a tool for her, and she doesn't really care about her sort of internal life or what happens to her. And it's very brutish. But then she's having this conversation with Cecily in her rooms, and she's just like, look, now is the moment you have to decide what kind of woman you're going to be. Like, you can have Val, you can have Sam, you can have your husband. Like, you can literally, you can do, like, if, as long as you learn how to master your own sexuality and sort of square the circle in your own head, you can, the world is yours. Like, she gives her this amazing piece of information, yeah, really, that even though she's being manipulative, it's also her entire credo, you know?
Yeah, I guess in a way she's, or thinks she's being kind of generous in giving that kind of advice. And in a way she is, because it does free Cecily in a way to sort of explore her sexuality with Val in a way that is just like, I mean, he's a skilled lover, all that kind of thing. And, mm-hmm, you know, that's not often the experience of a young woman, to find someone who knows how to deal with a woman's body or whatever. But then she can, so her plan is to sort of use that knowledge with the person she actually loves, Sam, so that they get the combination of the two. You know, she, I think there's something interesting going on about sex and love together within this story, and, you know, who gets to achieve that and who doesn't get both.
Yeah, it's so true. And it's so, and it's so, and Cecily is the only one who gets to have it, really. Mm.
Yeah.
And what's interesting as well, and keep it, yeah. What's interesting as well is that this thing of, I think about this a lot with the kind of fiction that we cover on this podcast, which some of it is quite, it's either set in the past, so it's dated in that way, or it's dated in that it was written in the 80s, where there is a lot to do with sort of huge age gaps, kind of a sense of like tutelage always going on between like, oh, he taught her how to be a lover, yeah, and all this kind of, all that sort of mess of stereotypes and stuff. And like, there's obviously like a modern, quite Twittery lens that's like, well, that's all yeah, fucked up.
Yeah.
But then that thing is like, those values don't carry over to the fantasy people want in romance.
Mm.
And I think in particular, the people who read these books the most, which are like quite young women who are just, yeah, like reading adult fiction for the first time, like maybe they've just graduated off Judy Blume and they're like, give me something raunchy, I need to know everything.
Yeah.
Or like maybe quite older, maybe quite conservative women, but they love the kind of, the fantasy of it is like, what if you didn't have to do anything and the, yeah, guy would make all these decisions for you, and you would just be swept along by this current, and the thing that would make you so irresistible is your lack of knowledge and your lack of experience. And I think that's a big thing for young women reading.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's so interesting that endures. It truly endures in a way that I find fascinating, because in modern day society, and as you say, in this sort of Twitter age where we're not supposed to want to engage with that kind of idea at all as women, that is still a perennial theme in romance that's written to this day. And it's not like those books are all rejected and everyone's like, no, we can't possibly read this. So there's something to be said for women who have been told you have to be strong and there's got to be equality and you shouldn't want this... you shouldn't want your sexual partner to be the person who takes charge. But the fact that that is still something that people crave says something psychologically about our society that I can't quite put my finger on. But it sort of, a relinquishing of control is something women, I think, deep down still kind of crave. And I don't know if it's even just women. I think it's people kind of don't want, you know, ideally, particularly in something as vulnerable as sex, you kind of don't want to have to also negotiate the idea that someone won't know you truly or won't know what to do and that you might have to, you know, do, yeah, something about it. So that's why it is a fantasy, and romance is kind of a fantasy. So it's really interesting the this whole idea of seduction, that you can just be sort of merrily going along on one path and then someone like blindsides you with their,
yeah,
deep sense of sexuality and you're sort of consumed. It's really interesting. And that's what's so interesting about the dynamics in this book as well. Like, obviously, Elizabeth, who to a certain extent is aware of like the potential of sex, but has made a deliberate choice to reject it. But then Val comes along and she, it's almost too hard for her to resist. And in a way, maybe, I don't know, is she the one more in control in their relationship in a funny sort of way, even though he's supposed to be the seducer?
Yeah, no, there's a really, I actually think that those, towards the sort of the last third of the book when Elizabeth and Val are together, is some of like the best romance writing I've really read. It's really affecting in a way that I probably won't be able to give, that really sent chills while I was reading it, but I probably won't be able to give much credence because I'm a terrible reader. this quote I just underlined a lot. He's like, he wanted to wander over every area, every scent of her, and to remember because it seemed he knew her before and had only forgotten her. He had been out of his mind for centuries until this moment when he recalled where he should be. And there's this sense of like this, and when they finally do get together, when they finally do sort of admit their love for each other, and they meet and they have sex, they just both weep, and this sense that they are each other's like home.
Yeah,
in a way, like I've heard that, I've read that so many times in like romancey books where it's like, oh, you're someone who's like home to me, and it's become almost like a cliche in itself. But this was the first time that it, really an author spent three pages spent like doing what does that mean when someone says that. So like I feel like she spends an awful lot of time on like the emotional calibrations of sex and love and what that means. But you actually don't get that much like bang on bang.
No, you really don't. For a book that kind of is in a way all about sex and sexuality and how people wield their sexuality, it's not actually I mean, there's maybe one or two like kind of, but not that graphic at all. And there's not really that much description of sex in like a functional, physical way. It is more about the emotions, or at least the two are tied together. Like she does a great job, as you say, of combining the sense of what the emotional impact is for the characters as well as the physical. I just think it's also interesting what happens to Elizabeth as well, like at the end, you know, her ending.
Should we talk about her ending? Let's go for it.
I mean,
spoilers.
Well, spoiler alerts. Yeah. But and it is also kind of, it's tweaked from what happens in the original. But Elizabeth commits suicide. She jumps out of her window after having been broken up with by Val, kind of at the behest of May. And she sort of doesn't realise that he's, or I guess he thinks that he's just kind of going to break up with her for May's benefit, and then he can just go back to Elizabeth and see, like, you know, it was just a ruse or whatever. But she's so distraught at the loss of Val that she takes her own life, which is sort of an odd... So I think in the original... that character just gets smallpox and sort of fades away. But her sort of, I guess it's a choice. I hesitate to say that, but the sort of loss of his love is like too much for her to bear. And I'm not quite sure how I feel about her doing that and her that making that decision. I mean, what did you think?
Yeah, I kind of, I did know that like from the offset they can't be together, right? That because it is this doomed love story and everything, and there is the set, it gets very murky after, because that whole bit is so depressing, because it's just
very, very
they have this beautiful, like he's chasing her for an entire summer, and he realizes that this love that he's been pretending to have is actually very, very real and means everything to him. And so she says this brilliant thing about, like, originally it was about this thing about his mission was to sort of erode her piety and erode her goodness, and so, to prove that it was all false and that he could penetrate anything, quite literally.
Yeah.
But actually what it ended up doing was her goodness ended up sort of eroding away at him, and it made him a better man as a result, which is, it was like, it's really, really beautifully written. And then he sort of reacts to it. He almost, like, he can't settle with this new personality, and then rejects her, and he sort of sleeps with prostitutes and sort of basically shoves it in her face. And then he gets very anxious about his reputation being lost and what that means. And then he just dumps her so he can sleep with May, and then May rejects him. And then he's like, what the hell am I doing? And he goes back to Elizabeth, and she jumps off the top of her building. And the entire time with her, she's just being like, I don't know how I can go on. And I enjoyed it from like a dramatic point of view.
Yeah.
But from like a, dramatic. What does this say about this strong character who she's the only real character who is like, I mean, they're all very like witty and there's a lot of like barbed banter, but she's able to really give back, but while still representing a very wholesome point of view.
Yeah.
But she's still a very rich character, and she's able to like go beat for like toe to toe with him all the time. And then for her to just like jump off a building, you're like, yeah. What?
I mean, I guess she kind of gives in to her desire, and then it does strike me that we don't see her get into a lot of anguish about, what about my husband? Like, she doesn't really consider him that much. And I guess at one point they speak on the phone and he's quite dismissive of her. So I guess maybe she feels that's justification. But I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, I suppose that Elizabeth sort of jumps so that Cecily can fly. Yeah, like she kind of, and I think even Cecily might think about the image of her jumping out of the window later on in the story, but Cecily is the only one who kind of gets everything that everybody wanted. Like, she really gets her cake and eats it too by the end of the story.
Just thinking as well, is that like, is that image is quite that sort of, you know, people, the building jump thing, it reminds me a lot of, have you ever read Passing by Nella Larsen?
Yes. Yeah.
Which is a book from this time period.
Yes, it
and
is.
That's how, and like, I think a character,
she does. Now that you mention it. And that's so interesting, because there's also mention within Unforgivable Love, Elizabeth is reading The Street by Anne Petrie, which is a real book that's set at the same time, you know, in Harlem in the 1940s. And I haven't read that myself, but I think it's similarly melodramatic and quite dark and depressing. I don't think things end up too well for the central character in that book. And I have the sense that Sophronia Scott has been kind of patterning Elizabeth's journey on, like, we see Elizabeth is the one reading that book within this book. So that sort of sad trajectory that she has maybe is inevitable. And it is melodramatic, and the whole book feels like a melodrama. So I guess, sort of from a narrative point of view, maybe it just plays into that sort of tragedy.
And also the sense of, it goes back quite early in her character, that like the tragedy of Elizabeth is like a death by a thousand cuts in a sense, because like obviously the Val thing, but there's also the sense that like she's this great mind, she like went to Vassar, and which weirdly I googled that because I was like, oh, were black women allowed in Vassar in 1940 whatever, and there was a very famous case.
That didn't even occur to me.
And the sense that like the only thing that she was ever got praise for was her piety, and that was the only place where her intellect could shine, was like her interpretations of scripture. And then like sort of she sort of betrayed her church by becoming this woman.
Yes.
This woman for Val Jackson, and she's betrayed her marriage. It's almost like there's no avenues left for her to turn to.
She's kind of, like, in a way, in giving in to Val, she's just kind of like, fuck it, I just want to be in love and have great sex, but then there is nowhere else for her to turn. She obviously can't tell her husband, by the way, I'm in love with Val Jackson. Like, that wouldn't have worked. She probably couldn't turn back to the church. So maybe in a way, she sort of takes that choice to be like, well, I've had everything that I wanted, and if I can't have Val, that's the end of the line for me, kind of thing, which is sad, but I guess kind of strong.
It definitely is a melodrama.
Because obviously Val also, you know, spoiler alert again, but Val doesn't make it all the way to the end of the story either. But he has like a really big arc of redemption that May doesn't get to have, because he sort of, it turns out that even though he has this reputation as being kind of amoral, it in the end, he was like donating to the church. And
it's such like a Shakespearean thing, isn't it? It's so like, he was noble after all.
Yeah, he kind of sacrifices himself. So he goes to, because Sam has found out that Val has been sleeping with Cecily, Val deliberately sort of waits till he can have an encounter with Sam. And then, like, certainly in the Dangerous Liaisons film, there's actually a duel where he sort of kind of commits suicide but doesn't. So he's actually wounded by the Sam character, whereas in this, in Unforgivable Love, he shoots himself. But it's quite a like a martyr kind of act, so that he gets to, I guess, have this, this arc of redemption, because it turns out he's impregnated Cecily, but he gives them like loads of money and Cecily can go and be with Sam. So he gets this big
and
redemptive
story. And Sam opens a club in North Carolina.
A little juke joint. You know, it all ends up fine. Well, not fine, but like Val, it's just, I do find it interesting that Val gets this whole arc of redemption, whereas May, who really isn't doing anything different to that than what Val is doing, is ostracized by her society. And, you know, it turns out, you know, like they sort of expose her as a liar because she's been saying that she's been donating money to the church. And obviously the church was quite central to that society at the time. But, you know, and she's sort of shunned and spat upon and, you know, run out of town almost.
Literally run out of church.
At
his funeral. Like, literally, they're all
like, oh, we had this guy wrong. And instead, everyone, you know, the whole sermon is about how she's a snake in their midst and she is literally spat upon and sort of runs away. And it's like,
I fell for her.
It's just really, I think that's a really interesting, you know, like, I'd quite like to see the story reversed and have the May type character have that redemptive arc and the man is the one who's just like shunned. But
it's never going to be that way around, is it? Just,
I mean, just the only redemption you do get from a female character is that Cecily gets to have had the sexual awakening and she gets the man that she loves and she's having this baby. She's set up for life. And she gets to go to the place, you know, back to North Carolina, which was where she felt happiest. And the story ends with her basically having everything she could want.
I really loved that as well. I loved the sort of relationship in the book between the North and the South. Because, like, there's definitely this narrative with African-American literature where it's like, leaving the South for the northern cities for a better life. Exactly, the Great Migration. And the fact that, like, this character goes back to the South and that's where she makes her life, and she's like, no, I don't want to be in this city where nothing grows. And I want to be in nature, and like, I deserve this, and this is mine. And she really takes ownership of that in a way that feels really like I don't think Scott puts this like big, like, oh, and this is what I'm doing here, but it feels really moving.
Definitely.
Because there's this bit earlier on when her aunt sort of says to her, her aunt is sort of talking about the various sort of like racism that they've experienced while living there. And it's, she says, Cecily wondered aloud why they stayed. Aunt Pearl shook her head and looked at her as though Cecily should already know the answer. If we left Cecily, then the better place would always be somewhere else.
Mm.
And like that, this thing of sort of like making your life in this place that's so, like, so dangerous for you, yes, or whatever, but finding the peace in that.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, it's almost like a rejection of that sort of American dream idea, you know, and the sort of power corrupting, an absolute power corrupting absolutely.
Yeah.
It's sort of a rejection of that, because the characters that are so drawn to being in America, drawn to wealth and drawn to wielding their power, I guess, you know, May, Val, they're the characters who end up dead. And I guess Elizabeth, for buying into that, also ends up dead, whereas Cecily rejects it and she's always felt most comfortable away from it, and she's the one who gets to thrive. But yeah, that's definitely, it's definitely an interesting dynamic. And it's interesting when May and Sam go off to Paris. Is it Paris? Yeah. And they do touch on the idea of feeling freer there, and that, you know, black Americans obviously did go over to Paris and felt like they were treated more as equals or human beings or intellectual equals. Yeah. But it's really, yeah, that, I think it's more the nature, as you say, it's the sort of connection that she has with the true, what the world around her, and growth and a natural change, rather than sort of being forced into a position.
Yeah. Finally, Sabrina Scott has said that, like, she would have loved to have this been a film. Mm. And apparently it started as a script.
Yeah.
How do you think it should be adapted? And who do you think should play the characters?
Well, I mean, it does, obviously, it's, the story itself has been made into a film many times, but with this one, it's so cinematic. Like, her description is so gorgeous.
And the clothes, there's so much, like,
Dior, you can just imagine how sumptuous, because that's, I think that's something that you miss, or certainly I miss, with, like, Cruel Intentions, where, you know, it's very 90s. Doesn't Joshua Jackson have, like, some bleached hair or something, like, frosted tips are happening? So, but with Dangerous Liaisons, the sort of 88 version, where they're in, like, the French petticoats and, you know, everything's all gorgeous and sumptuous and powdered wigs and stuff. With the 1940s Harlem, you really get that sense of, like, the costumes will be all gorgeous and the music will be amazing.
Yeah.
But in my head, I was picturing Mahershala Ali the whole time as Val. He has that gorgeous gleaming smile. That I think would be perfect. And for May,
I was thinking Tessa Thompson for May.
Yeah, maybe Tessa Thompson. I think she could do it. Or I really am a fan of Susan Kelechi Watson, who is in This Is Us. She's the wife of Sterling K. Brown. She would be great. She has that kind of edge to her. I think you... And I think Tessa Thompson has that as well. But I can't really... I don't know with the other characters, with Cecily and Elizabeth. I'm not sure. But it does feel so ripe for a film adaptation. Yeah. I'd watch the hell out of
that. It feels really ripe for, like, a big Netflix adaptation.
Yeah.
Or even, like a one of those, like, big Crazy Rich Asians opening weekends.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
would be great.
Who would be responsible for that? I don't know, but I'd love to see it.
So tell me a little bit about your new book, which came out in June. You were lucky enough to also be a fellow pandemic author.
Yes.
So my salutations to you.
Yes, I mean, it's another black love story, which I think is what I love so much about Unforgivable Love. But my book is called If I Don't Have You, and it is a story about a black British woman. She's an artist living in New York, And she, for some crazy reason, really wants to stay in the States. And so she has sort of secretly agreed, not secretly, but she's agreed to marry a guy who's her business partner just so she can stay in the States and continue her business, which is sort of like a web magazine. And she's also an artist. And she is sent to interview a film director. He's really hot. He's American. Their sparks fly and they end up being grounded together in New York by a storm. They both are at the airport, meet each other again, you know, sort of later the day after they've had the interview, and fall in love over the course of a night and sort of a before sunrise-ish
way. Airport hotel.
Yes. Well, yes, very much so. And then they decide to kind of just keep things going when she has to go back to London. But various things get in the way and secrets and all sorts. And then they get a chance to reconnect years later. It's in sort of three parts.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
That sounds lovely. And like, where, sexiness level, where are we at? Are we sexier than Unforgivable Love?
It's pretty sexy. Yes, it's pretty sexy. Yeah.
So what's your approach to, I'm writing a book at the moment where it's, on which I didn't see coming, but it's really become about the sex scenes. And I'm like, wow, this has become more about sex than I thought it was going to be. What's your approach to writing them?
I mean, I do actually kind of, I like the approach that Sophonian Scott does with the kind of thinking more about how, what's the emotional takeaway from this scene? Why are they interacting in this way? What happens?
Mm.
So I think I'm quite conscious of what kind of sex they have and what that says about them as characters, but other than that, it needs to like genuinely feel sexy, like not kind of icky. I don't know, it's quite hard to describe. Yeah,
it's a very blurry line,
exactly, because obviously bad sex really sticks in the mind on the page and in probably in real life too. So I think making sure that it seems like it would be good, depending on what you're writing, of course. Like, I'm writing romance where the idea of the interaction between the characters is for it to be good. Of course, you can have sex where it's supposed to be bad or something bad's happened or whatever. But, yeah, I don't know. I think it's just sort of just going for it and not really thinking about like, oh, someone's going to read this. It's really embarrassing. Like I never, but it's, then I started
it's
out
always that mission in divorcing. Fiction. Oh, you started out writing erotic fiction.
Yeah, that was the first stuff I had published, which was not intentional, but I work in publishing and way back in the annals, I worked at a place that won the publishing for Agent Provocateur, the underwear company. They were doing two or three anthologies of sexy stories. And even though I worked in like sales and marketing or something, I was like, can I try? And they liked what I wrote. And I wrote like three or four erotic fiction stories, never written any erotica before. But that was the first stuff I did. And then they asked me to write an erotic novella. And also, so I guess I had a grounding in sexy stories.
That is amazing to me. I can't believe that, like, you literally, like, most people, like, fight to keep this kind of thing from their colleagues, but you were like...
Pretty much. I don't really know what came over me, but I was like, yeah, I guess I just wanted to write move. Something. Yeah.
Of course. Oh, my God. So respect the hustle. That's so cool. What an amazing way into writing novels.
Yeah. So I mean, but then the book I wrote as my actual like proper debut that wasn't commissioned was there's no sex in it. It's quite sad. So I guess I like kind of moved away from that for a bit. But for this, for If I Don't Have You, I kind of just wanted to, particularly with black love stories, you hardly ever get a story that is devoid of trauma, which I mean, it's a shame that Unforgivable Love, a lot of trauma in there, but kind of
Yeah, but they bring it on themselves. Yeah, exactly. Than, like,
and like I say, it's within their own community. It's not like there's sort of a white gaze coming in and say, like, and that's the source of all their troubles. So, but with If I Don't Have You, there is kind of melodrama, but nobody's flying off buildings or anything. it's just, yeah, I just wanted to write a romantic story that was genuinely between two Black people and them just trying to figure it out in kind of a realistic way, but with that sense with romance that there's always that slight guarantee that like you kind of feel at least they're going to be together by the end of this story, or it's kind of, in my mind at least, not really a romance, at least if they don't have like a happy for now situation by the end of the book. But yeah.
That sounds wonderful and very sexy. Because really, I feel like I was promised a lot of sex for Unforgivable Love. And I didn't get that didn't much. Really, so I feel like I'm going to be making up the difference with your book.
Yes, I hope so. I hope so.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZaroLineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.